Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial. It's time for the Disciplined Investor Podcast. How are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and I'm kind of excited to hopefully raise your spirits a little bit, at least from some of the doom and gloom we've been seeing out there. And you know me, I'm all for if it's doomy and gloomy, we're going to try to make money that way. If it's happy and pappy, we're going to go in that direction. But right now, we're kind of at the crossroads. We're at the crossroads of an economic slowdown that may be what they're calling a pause. And even using some agricultural phrases like a soft patch, kind of like, I think, coming from the old green shoots. They're trying to revive the whole idea of pastures and greener ways and great opportunity for sprouts growing and trees budding. And this is just a point of time where, well, we're just in a soft patch. It sounds much better than saying we're in a slowdown, doesn't it? But we're seeing an economic slowdown from most of the indicators, at least, if not a slowdown, a leveling off right now from a growth phase that we saw over the last 6-7 months. On top of that, there's a lot of concern about Europe, of course, China slowing down. We're going to get to that. And I'm going to talk to you about some things that we have been kind of looking at from the perspective of where the markets can go. All that's going to be ahead. And we're also talking with Tim Seymour. You know him from Fast Money on CNBC. He usually sits on the left, all the way left, gives great advice when it comes to emerging markets. He runs a hedge fund. He also runs a great website. And he has lots and lots of background and information on the emerging markets. I thought that would be a great thing to talk about. We really haven't talked about that in a while, so we're going to get to Tim Seymour in a little while. In addition to that, right after we talk to Tim, I'm going to answer some of your questions. We have a lot of comments, more than questions, that came in over the last couple of weeks, and I wanted to take a few of those and really explore some of those. In the meantime, I'll mention one thing, one comment that I got, actually not one, but three this week, was that people are having a hard time finding us. Now, I don't understand, but maybe it's me. You know, you just simply go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I guess maybe some of the new people, if you're new and you're listening, maybe this is what it is, because maybe the people that are used to the site and the website and all that know their way around, the old timers. But you newbies who are new to The Disciplined Investor, just go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and in the show notes or the podcast section right on the top right, you'll find all the show notes and the past archive of the podcast. In addition to that, for anybody that does want to have some money managed in a professional manner, in a hedge fund-like structure, but not a hedge fund, where you actually have access to your money and you can see your account at any given time because it's in your name. We manage money on a fully transparent basis. As a matter of fact, we're going to get to that in a second, what we talked to our clients this week, this letter we wrote to our clients this week. And if you want to take a look at that and find out more, there's a 14-minute virtual tour. Simply go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's a big blue box right on the right. Click that and take a look. It's me talking through how we manage money. Minimum investment is $50,000. Not for everybody. It's more of an aggressive approach. But if you're interested in kind of getting involved in this market and playing the ups and the downs, that's where it is, over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So, okay, lots to talk about. Big turnaround last week, wasn't there? I mean, that was a pretty – I got all this paper I'm shuffling around here because I got lots of things to talk to you about. But last week was an amazing turnaround from what was considered by some to be a terribly, terribly oversold situation. So when we look at that, why did that happen? And what does that really tell us about what can be happening in the future. So I wanted to start with something that we wrote to our clients. We have a letter that we write each and every week that discusses some of the outlook, as well as each and every day we outline what's going on, the news, the economic news, about the stocks we own, about some of the countries we're involved with, some charts and graphs on economics, et cetera. And I want to read you the top of what we wrote this week, because I think that's going to really give you a good summation of what's happening, because there's a lot of confusion out there. You're probably confused, I know. I mean, there's a lot of cross currents, there's a lot of questions, and the real issue is going to come next week when we have earnings coming up. But listen what we said. Basically, that, you know, clearly it was a quick turnaround from an oversold condition, and it took markets around the world just higher, all over the world. Even China, China's been a disaster lately, down 25% for the year, has managed to have some nice days last week. And over the past few weeks, we have been wondering why all the pessimism is starting to flare up. And sure, there is a continuing saga in the Eurozone, which by the way, had a terrific week last week. And we also saw the euro pop to about 127 against the U.S. dollar last week. That was pretty impressive. And, of course, we have these slowing and stalling economic indicators right now. And then what happened was, you know, on one side, there we had the likes of Robert Prechter predicting the Dow Jones at 1,000. They marched him out in the media again and had the media talking about this whole nasty environment that could be happening over the next 5 years. And, of course, by the way, I did say 1,000, not 10,000, 1,000. And that was sometime in the next 5 years. Then we had Barton Biggs. He was all over the news, and he said that he sold 50% of his tech holdings with his hedge fund. Of course, that was at the low point of the markets about 2 weeks ago. And for good measure, let's just top it off. The cherry on the top of the negativity was Rubini again with his ghastly apocalyptic calls. So it's really no wonder that all the bad news and negative sentiment is there, and an inevitable pop from the bottom. Usually you see when things get so awful, you get this tremendous pop and this tremendous upsurge when things get so oversold. But there was another story that really caught our eye last week about famed investor John Paulson. You know who he is. He runs a hedge fund, and he made a bundle off the subprime disaster. And now he's been making a big bet on gold. But it appears that he's been having some real trouble. Let me tell you what was being said about him. He has about $33 billion in assets. He booked losses on his Advantage fund. It's his Advantage Plus fund and his $30 billion recovery fund, according to research and press releases. His $9 billion Advantage fund lost 4.4% in June, leaving it down about 6% for the year so far. And this comes on top of a 6.9% drop in May. Meanwhile, his Advantage Plus fund fell 6.9% in June, bringing it to a total loss of about 9% in the first half of the year, according to Bloomberg. So what's interesting, if we tie together the Barton Biggs news and the Paulson confession, it shows there was indeed a good amount of what we talked about. We've been talking about this forced selling that occurred at the end of June. This is something that's really, it's usually hard to prove until sometime after the event, but the way the stocks moved down the final weeks of June was curious at best. So for now, we could see that there is more money in cash, either looking to move back in if earnings and outlook are strong, or kind of remain in cash if not. I hope, by the way, I'm not boring you with this, but I want to give you a taste of what we talk about with our clients, you know, and kind of giving them an outlook. So what I also said was on the other side of the argument for a bounce was Tom McClelland and Richard Arms. Of course, during the show, we've had Tom McClelland on before, and we've written about him, and we posted his information about the McClelland Oscillator on the sites. But this week, they really looked at the possibility that we were in such an oversold condition. In fact, in the latest Arms advisory, Richard Arms, he used the word unprecedented to describe the oversold conditions that were showing up in his indicators. And that was on July 6th. Pretty good call. We know what happened, of course, since then. And he went on to discuss that he believed that this time is no different than other times that we saw the selling. And we have seen all this coming to an end, at least for now. Now, the other thing that's happening is next week is the big issue. So we saw this big run-up and probably a lot of short covering from the color on the desk we got. We saw a lot of short covering, some buyers stepping in. But usually what we've seen over the last few weeks is some selling, not a lot of short selling, and some short covering. Not a lot of volume. As a matter of fact, last week on Friday was the lowest volume of the year so far. Because next week is the official start of earnings season, and Alcoa will start it off at the close on Monday. Then a few banks are reporting, and we're also going to see Google, Intel, GE, you know, just to name a few. And here's what I think and we wrote is going to be happening. Of course, all eyes will be on the earnings forecast, right? But close attention will be paid to the outlook and guidance. And here's what we'll be watching for. These are the real important points I think a lot of analysts will be looking at. How upbeat is management about next year? Will earnings growth continue? Will they be adding employees? How will the European austerity measures affect them? I mean, think about that for a second. You know, we need to look at all these kind of points individually, but all together to see how this is going to affect corporate bottom line, the profits. What will the cost be of the healthcare reform? I mean, we've seen some of this come out already, but the healthcare reform, you know, how much is it really going to affect their bottom line? Will we see more dividend and buyback plans? There's a tremendous, about $1 trillion in cash right now that's sitting on the books and in cash at firms. So what are they going to be doing with that? What's their bet now? If they say buyback plans, we could sort of assume that they're a little bit positive about their future. The other thing we're looking at is what are the margin and tax assumptions into 2011, 2012? So when you start seeing earnings come out, you know, maybe write down these points. Cost factors are also going to be an issue with the regard to the yuan float. And is that going to help or hurt their profits? So, of course, obviously, these questions will differ from company to company to company, right? As will what we'll be looking for. So for banks, we're looking for earnings and spreads along with the projected loan delinquency data. Materials companies will be watched for raw material cost assumptions, and the consumer discretionary companies will be sharing details on the strength of the consumer. Now, beyond all this, beyond all the earnings, there are a few other catalysts that are going to present themselves over the next few weeks. Congress is back in session. Whoa, joy. I don't know about you, but it was nice when they were out of session for a week, wasn't it? Stress tests on 91 European banks will be released. And on the table back again for another round is the financial reform bill and the vote to extend the emergency unemployment benefits through the end of the year, which has failed, I think it's four times it's failed so far. Now, there's going to be some reprieve, though. Most of the big economic numbers will be released towards the end of July, providing less news for traders to deal with, which will be good. And just one more point we wrote about, it was that we're watching the 1094 to the 1120 range for the S&P 500. Now, bulls will win over the top if we get over clearly the 1094, but the 1120 number. But if it fails to break 1094 and gets stuck at that level, we could be looking at a false breakout in a bear trend. As a matter of fact, I talked to my friend Corey Rosenblum a lot about that this week, and we have to be looking at where that is. So that's kind of the stuff we write to our clients on a weekly basis. But I want to share that with you, since a lot of you don't have access to our private client site, and that's updated every day. We talk about things. And then from there, by the way, we also talk about each and every day what's going on and what happened throughout the week. But I thought it was really important prior to the big earnings week coming out and in advance of all the things we'll be seeing from Congress and we're going to be seeing around the world, that we have a little bit of a heads up on that. I'm going to put those questions that I just talked about, things that we're going to be looking at through earnings season, on the show notes. I want you to have those. So when you see the earnings come out, and if you listen to conference calls, and if you look at the various earnings reports and releases beyond just the press release that comes out, these are the things you want to key into and look at it from a comparative standpoint. Okay? And also, we want to look at what analysts are doing. That's really important. I think that you have to look at those two things. Right now, we saw a lot of analyst upgrades up until a couple of weeks ago, and now we're starting to see, you know, things being brought down. We saw Intel being brought down last week. A lot of the banks, Meredith Whitney came out, and she downgraded Goldman and Morgan Stanley. And, you know, we have to look at what are analysts going to do post-earnings. Are they going to keep their levels the same with price targets and with their EPS and revenue targets? Or are they going to be changing dramatically? These are all the things that are going to go into what happens. Now, I'll give you my best estimation just for a moment. Again, we haven't seen anything, but here's what it looks like. There's been a lot of pessimism in this market over this particular quarter. We've always said that the second half, towards the end of the second half, we're going to see a slowdown in the U.S. economy and possibly the world economies. But what seemed to have happened was that Europe acted as more than a catalyst, but they really did with all the things that happened there, they accelerated the potential for a slowdown. Now, slowdowns aren't necessarily bad, and you know, everybody in everybody's head is this whole idea that if we slow down, we're just going down and down and down forever. That's not the case, but of course, we have to look at what the earnings outlook and the multiples will be if there is a slowdown and how much that will really affect the bottom line of companies. But at the same time, there still is some bright spots, and at the same time, there's some shorting opportunities. You have to look at both sides. But when we look at this, it looks like the pessimism that is put into this quarter from an earnings standpoint is a little bit misguided. The question is going to be the back half of 2011 and into 2012, if we can maintain a reasonable amount of growth over the level of what is expected right now. We're looking at a 28% growth of EPS on a year-over-year basis for the S&P 500 companies. Question is going to be, can we even keep a 20% growth, which is the number we probably have to see to prevent the stock market from really seeing a big downturn, crashing through the low below 1,000 towards its next logical point about 950 on the S&P 500. So, you know, traders, investors, mutual fund managers are all going to be watching all these things. These are things I want you to watch as well. These are things we talk about, by the way, when it comes to fundamental analysis in The Disciplined Investor, the book you can grab over at Amazon for, I don't know, 12 bucks, 13 bucks, something like that. There's a whole section on this fundamental analysis, what you need to be looking at when it comes to earnings season and the ratios and all these different things. So I think I want to spend extra time on that today. Hopefully I didn't bore you to death with that. But if you want to make money in this environment, this is what you have to look at. And these are things you need to key into. All right, so let's kind of draw a line right there. And we're going to move on. We're going to move on. Yes, we're moving on. Let's bring in Tim Seymour. Let's hook it all up, get into a discussion about emerging markets. I have a few questions about what his favorite is and what he sees in some of the BRIC states, BRIC countries, and I'm very interested in talking to him. This is the first time I'm actually bringing him on, and I think he's going to do a great job. I've seen him before in action, and this guy knows his stuff. So stick around. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, we're back, and as promised, we brought Tim Seymour on. Actually, a great guy. If you've seen him on Fast Money, he's amazing. He runs SideGem, an asset management firm, and EmergingMoney.com. And we're going to talk all about emerging markets because we really haven't done that in a while. We've talked about, you know, options with John Najarian recently. We talked about a variety of screening tools with Charles Kirk recently. We talked about with Cake Stalter from Investors Business Daily. But you know what? This is the guy. Tim, you're the guy. You're the go-to guy.
That's what they say. Well, I tell you what, you know, what's amazing to me, and I've been in emerging markets for 15 years, is that, you know, these are markets that to me are crucial to really all of the world's markets. You know, we try to make the argument that emerging markets have decoupled, and while I'd say that they probably have on an economic basis, they clearly haven't from a markets perspective. And you just don't get a lot of emerging markets commentary in the media, and it's amazing because there's tons of guys that have been doing it as long as I have, and there's a lot of really smart guys in the space. So what I'm really trying to do on Fast Money is try to put a little bit more of an emerging markets context on the news that we're all watching every day. So whether it's what's happening in Europe and the growth scare, whether we're talking about you know, FinReg in the U.S. or whether we're you know, talking about the labor numbers that are coming down the pike, all of this has an application for emerging markets. And I think most people would be surprised at the impact that a lot of these countries are going to have on their lives, if not, you know, in the markets today, absolutely tomorrow.
Yeah, so let's kind of make our way around the horn, so to speak, here, right? Let's just start with Australia for a second. The bonehead move of the century by the former Prime Minister, right, Rudd, who wanted
exactly.
I was shocked, actually. That was like kind of like, this is really happening. Although I got to tell you something, the party taking over didn't seem to do a lot, in my opinion, except for to exclude a few players who really barked the loudest, right? What was that about?
It was political suicide, and it was clearly a case where you have to understand with the hand that feeds you, the mining industry is what's been putting Australia is one of the most impressive economic stories in the last probably 10 years. And it's clear that not only if as a pure economist you looked at the taxation kind of, you know, if you're a free, let's put it this way, if you're a free market or supply side economist, you're going to have all types of complaints and criticisms of that approach. But just understanding really where the balance of power lies in Australia, the mining industry is crucial. So, you know, it's ultimately, you know, something that I'm not surprised to see has been tempered down. I think the market's response to how it traded BHP in Rio Tinto is kind of the two bellwethers was not a big surprise, but actually it was complicated by the move we were seeing down in markets and commodities in general. And I think, you know, that's where people might have overplayed from a markets perspective what the super mining tax might have meant to those guys. I don't think in reality, even if there hadn't been the change on top, that would have ultimately been something that trickled through to the bottom line. And again, we were talking about taxes that were not going to come online for a couple more years. I think from a trader's perspective, I think you were trading Rio Tinto and BHP mostly based upon the economic data we were getting out of China and the slowdown in PMIs.
Yep, absolutely. Which has been the funniest thing, we've talked about this before on the show and a few others, that, you know, we all were crying, or generally, I'm talking, but generally, you know, China needs to slow down. China's going to bubble out. China's going to explode. And then China starts slowing down and everybody starts freaking out.
Yeah, well, it's people, you know, they can't have it either way, and that's right. I mean, so if you listen to a guy like Stephen Roach, who runs Morgan Stanley's Asia business, and the guy that's been in that region for a long time, I think he's got one of the most, you know, kind of sober views on China, and has been the most accurate when he says, look, 8-9% growth in China is what you're going to get this year, and if that's at the slow end of the curve, then, you know, you probably have it about as good as you can get. The reality is that the biggest issues for China over the last 2 to 3 years have not been growth. They've been inflation.
Right.
They've been issues that have been related to social pressures that come with when food prices, when pork prices, you know, when we had the pig disease out there, and we had a number of things that were pushing the everyday feedstock for the masses in China higher and higher. That's what put the government under pressure. So do they have a property bubble? I bet they do. And I think it exists not necessarily on the consumer level where it exists in the United States. I think it exists with these urban trusts that effectively have been taking all these free or these very, these very cheap loans that have been coming out of the government, and they've been reinvesting into mostly commercial properties. So, you know, are there issues in China? Are there greater issues that could disrupt the global growth story? For sure. Is China going to turn around and stop? No. And is China, are they able to manipulate their economy better than any other economy in the world, despite the fact that they happen to be, you know, the second largest now at this point?
I think they just
announced. I'm not real worried.
Did they announce today another $100 billion infrastructure stimulus?
They did. And you know, we're going to get announcement on loans coming out in the next couple of days. And in fact, the money supply in China is continuing to move out, you know, to levels we saw in the kind of the most buoyant part of last year. So M2 is probably going to be up another 25% this month. The new yuan loans number is going to come out probably the 11th, and that's looking about another $600 billion in yuan loans. Now, if you remember, the big thing that we were concerned about is that at the beginning part of the year, they were cutting their loans down to about 30% of what they'd lent out in 2009. I don't think that that's going to hold. So
right.
The stimulus, the money supply, their ability to take their foot off the brake, I think is actually something that people underestimate.
Yeah, so we're going to have only a few more minutes. I want to talk about some of the things. One of my favorite areas in Asia right now is Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And simply, there's a lot of problems there, obviously. But one of the things that happened was that, again, back to China, just keeps on, everything goes back to China. China just put on a cross-border treaty and is going to treat them with more of a favorable nation, I guess is the best way to describe it, right?
Yep.
Do you like Taiwan?
I do like Taiwan, and obviously, if you like tech here, you like Taiwan, and I think...
Oh, Samsung's numbers were unbelievable, weren't they?
Yeah, Samsung, which is actually Korean. But I mean, Samsung, if you're looking at the whole region and Taiwan's impact, absolutely. I mean, Samsung's numbers were great. I love the impact one of the stories that the themes we apply in Trading the Globe, which is one of the shows we're doing on CNBC, is, you know, we call it What About Us? And we talk about what the U.S. companies and how they're affected by what's going on. And you know, what's happening with LG and Samsung, but even Optronics in Taiwan, AUO ticker, or even, you know, companies like Chunghwa Tel and some of the other bellwethers out there, mm-hmm. is that the, you know, Apple and Microsoft and Intel, you know, a big part of their revenue stream is coming from either the guys that are supplying the underlying components ultimately to the finished products like the iPhone, or guys that actually they're subbing out a lot of their underlying chips to. The other great story in Taiwan is HTC. Now that we're talking about Apple, I mean, HTC, I would argue, might be the most impressive and advanced handset maker in the world. Forget about Apple. Forget about Nokia.
No, but we need the Apple OS on that.
Exactly. Well, we need the Apple OS, and you know, a lot of people in the States just need to be able to buy HTC on U.S. you know, U.S. exchanges, and they'd probably know a lot more about it.
Right.
But this is a company that's been white labeling cell phones to some of the biggest producers in the world.
The first one's from Microsoft. The first one from Microsoft. The first, remember that Microsoft device? It was a compact device. But those were all, after that, all HTC. And it was all white labeled. You didn't know what it was. It was fabulous. I think it was called the iPack. It was great.
Yep. It's a great phone. And, you know, it's certainly indicative of both the quality of the technology that's been coming out of Taiwan for a long time. And you know, I would argue are going to be some of the more important companies for tomorrow. But, you know, you talk about the relationship with China. Taiwan's exports to the mainland have surged 60% year over year to Hong Kong. To the mainland, they're roughly about 49%. So it's an impressive story, and obviously the relationship on the political level has been one that's been going through a transformation over the last 2 years specifically, and I expect that to continue. But the other ingredient to helping Taiwan and even helping the entire region has also been this decision, or at least this slow movement we're seeing in the revaluation of the yuan, taking the pressure off the other currencies to have to be pegged to a currency that's, you know, artificially cheap is something that's actually very positive for them, as they too also have had to fight very hard against inflation. So their ability to let their currencies float a little more freely is going to make the whole region a little more competitive.
Just a quick note, trading the globe.
Yep.
I only saw that once, but I was very impressed. You had a net, because you're like the commentator on there. You're like the host.
Hosting on that. Well, thank you, Andrew. I mean, you know, ultimately what we're doing here is again trying to put emerging markets into a context where we can help people understand, first of all, how they want to attack investing in these markets. Some of the themes that I think you're going to see, whether it's the global auto trade, whether it's the middle class and demographic that, you know, in India has these guys buying their first, you know, moving from a bicycle to a car, or in China buying their, or in Brazil, the real middle class buying their first home, or in India where internet penetration is only 8%. You know, we talk forever about China. You know, India might even be a more impressive story with 1.2 billion people. So trading the globe, it's about slowing down. It's about getting some of these concepts. It's about giving people actionable names they can trade, and ideally my seat, I'm able to be a host and facilitate a conversation that I know pretty well, but then I can put my hedge fund hat back on and you know, give some ideas and say, hey, you know, I was just out in Russia last week, and you know, here's what I was seeing on the ground, and here's then how this influences how I'm going to invest there. So hopefully I'm the right guy to lead that conversation, and it's great that CNBC recognizes and the interest we've had from viewers to have more of this. We're actually going to do four more shows this fall.
This seems like a great travel gig too. But that's a side.
It's not bad. You know, it's funny when you're a younger man than I am now, or when you're a younger man that I was at one point. Traveling around the world was as exciting a thing to do. Now my wife doesn't love it as much, and you miss the family a little more.
Right.
But it is exciting, and it's, you know, this is, to me, the only place, the only asset class to be investing in. You know, emerging markets, to me, is where the growth is, and where you're seeing companies that are reshaping the world, and where you're seeing some of the you know, the least known world-class companies around. In other words, you've got companies that have been leaders in their class. You know, we talked about HTC, a Tenaris, a Gazprom, a Petrobras. I mean, these are companies that are some of the most companies in the world.
Right, and let's talk about some of the put your hedge fund hat back on. You said the housing in Brazil. You have Gafisa, GFA, right?
Sure.
That's a great play, although it's been very volatile. Let's just also
state
that.
It's been a volatile play. You know, from putting my trader's hat on, what you have to be careful about in the housing sector in Brazil is that actually it's become a crowded trade, and it's a trade that you've seen a lot of crossover investors in. It's one of the places that actually, in the last 6 weeks, with the market volatility, is a trade we've tended to be on the short side of.
Mm-hmm.
We think valuations got a little stretched. We also see a lot of these crossover investors, guys that have been investing in Chinese real estate, coming into Brazil because, you know, they get the big thematic story, and that's, you know, that's great. But in some cases, what these guys don't know is that actually interest rates are going higher in Brazil. That in the case of Gafisa and Sorella and, you know, a number of the other big homemakers, they're actually building up inventory that may be a problem. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, while we're very bullish on this middle-class housing story in Brazil, I think rates are going higher. I think margins are getting squeezed for these guys a little bit. And I think in many cases, they're building houses that they don't have demand for right now, even though I expect they will have it for tomorrow. Gafisa is a great company.
Yep.
The other problem here is that you saw an enormous amount of capital markets activity in the sector. So you saw $3 to $4 billion in new equity issuance in the fall and through the first quarter. That's put a lot of pressure on the sector, and reason why I think it may be a little heavy here.
And this is still with the fact that the government has put a tax on foreign investment in the Brazil, right?
Yeah,
they never lifted that.
Yeah, I mean this tax is something that, you know, for us as a hedge fund, for example, means that if we put new money into Brazil, we're taxed 2% on it, and so it was ultimately the incentive for the government was to try to smooth out the volatility of capital flows at a time when they were very worried about.
So if you buy Gafisa if you buy the EWZ ETF, how do you get taxed?
You are not taxed.
Right.
If you're playing in the ADRs, you're fine.
Right.
And I think this is where people need to stay focused. At least if you're not a dedicated investor that's buying local Brazilian shares. I mean, in many cases, a lot of the stocks that we want to buy, we'd rather buy them in the locals. And so as a hedge fund, we're set up to trade locally. We'll have money, you know, quote unquote, in the local market already. We'll have paid our 2% in. And then when we sell shares, we'll keep it in real. We won't necessarily transfer it out of the country and back into our custodian bank. And it's a long way of saying that we get charged 2% once, but we don't keep getting charged 2%.
Right.
We keep our money in reais, then we're fine. But this was a sign to investors, you know, back in the fall that Brazil wasn't necessarily, you know, the green light, everything's friendly, and, you know, steamroll ahead. And I think it's, you know, a theme that you have to be careful of in emerging. It's not necessarily that the governments there are looking to, you know, do away with Western investors, but you can bet that in the cases where you've got countries, they're going to act in their best interest. And in Brazil's case, they thought that the capital flows were getting a little hot for them, that their currency was getting a little expensive, and they were looking to slow that down.
All right, one last question real quick, one-word answer. We'll call this the final trade of the day. So I made that up myself.
I like it.
What country's your favorite?
One word answer. Turkey.
Okay, Turkey. I mean, if it was the United States, it could have been two words, but Turkey. Turkey is very interesting. The Young Turks, the whole thing that's going on there, really interesting. A little bit of political issues there, obviously, but Turkey's kind of cool. I'm agreeing with you. And there's a good ETF. I think it's TUR, I believe, is the symbol, right?
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Or, you know, even play TKC, which is Turkcell, and it's certainly a conduit for playing the consumer. I would always argue that, you know, buying cellular companies in emerging, are you're getting some of the best companies, and in this case, you're getting a company that is probably indicative of the real disposable income growth that's going on in Turkey.
I hear you. Tim Seymour, emergingmarkets.com. We'll put some links there. CNBC's Fast Money at 5 p.m. in the evening. I like when you used to replay it at midnight. You don't do that anymore, so I can't do it that much. And SciGem Asset Management, he runs a hedge fund. I want to thank you for joining us. And I actually sent you some GDP numbers. Did you get that?
I did.
Okay, so check that out. Tell me what you think of it in a side note. Write me back about that, if those are even near accurate. I'll put that on the website, too, what we think is going to happen. Thanks so much for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Great, Andrew. Thanks a lot.
Hey, so, wow, good information there on emerging markets. You know, the ones that we really prefer right now are Taiwan. Turkey is interesting. We've looked at that before, but there was some issues there that were concerning about some political issues and some problems, particularly with what's going on in the Middle East right now, and that kind of held us back a little bit. But Taiwan, Brazil, India, and Hong Kong are key, as well as Mexico. Mexico is our biggest trading partner in the United States, and we thought that was interesting to take a look at because it will go with what happens with the U.S. But more importantly, the Taiwan situation, where the two things are happening, the yuan revaluation, or at least the unpegging from the dollar, would be helpful to Taiwan, in our opinion, if they are going to have the opportunity to trade with China, one of the biggest trading partners of China. And on top of that, they finally signed that cross-border agreement where they were going to give a bit of a favorable nation. Now, we talked about this just a moment ago, but I think it's something you want to take a look at. All these have ETFs that are available to invest in, and it's probably the easiest way to do so. Now, with an ETF, you have to remember something. You're going to bear the brunt of currency exchange issues. Now, in history that we've looked back on, there hasn't been as much currency jockeying and these abnormalities that we've seen of late, you know, when we see a 2% move on a day. I mean, it used to be you had a 1% move and everybody was under the desk saying, "Oh my God, the world is ending." But you're seeing big moves in currencies on a regular basis. You know, obviously a lot of that has to do with Europe and the instability there and the dollar and the moving around and the carry trades that we've talked about, where one currency is being used for the other and then possibly borrowing, all this going on. But Taiwan is a really interesting play, EWT. The other things you want to look at is South Korea, I think. You also want to look at Singapore. All these are available through ETFs and primarily good ones through iShares and a few others. EPI is a symbol for the ETF over in India that we like, EWZ for Brazil, EWW for Mexico, EWW. What I miss? EWS for Singapore, and I think I covered them all just right now. What I miss? Hong Kong, FXI. So anyway, that covers a lot of them. Take a look at those. They have a great opportunity. Their economies are growing very nicely, even though we're seeing a little bit of a slowdown from some GDP standpoints into 2012. 2011 still looks like a really good opportunity for many of the emerging markets. But rest assured, whatever happens to the U.S. will also happen in the emerging markets. It's just the way the world is. This, you know, ability for any one country to act alone and break out these days is really not occurring. Like, for example, Peter Schiff mentioned that was his basis for investing in China for a few years. He thought there'd be a significant decoupling of the economies. He was right on the economies, potentially, but at the same time, the stock markets still follow each other. Anyway, I thought I'd go through a couple of these comments and things that we have to talk about. If you want to email me, of course, simply write to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor. So this is from Demarius, and Demarius writes in that, "Hi, Andrew. I went actually and listened back to podcast 148 with Harry Dent, and there seems to be a ton of truth in his evaluation of the current economic situation. I started listening to your podcast in 2007. Awesome. And I listened to the podcast that Mr. Dent was on, and the podcast is the sole reason, well, this is interesting, sole reason I pulled my money out of the market on December 28th, 2007. Terrific. Thanks. My concern today is, however, is the growing debt this country is accumulating, and I don't believe it will be balanced. And I don't believe with, I do believe that we are headed for our own currency crisis is almost unavoidable. I hope that I'm wrong, but hope won't fix the situation. Only less government spending will, and I don't see that happening in the foreseeable future. What are your thoughts?" I can't argue. I think that you're really right about this. The problem is that we still need, and don't shoot the messenger here, folks, we still need a little bit more stimulus, whether it's just the reinstatement of the employee, the unemployment insurance, the emergency benefits right now, or we need, we need the equivalent of stimulus or a shot right in the heart, you know, right in the arteries. We don't need this filtering system where any stimulus is going to go through, first of all, the congressional process, where we're going to have a tremendous amount of earmarks and special items and pork. And that is not going to help us. And we know that from the past, that's not going to help us. Now, is that unavoidable? Possibly. Really, and probably, by the way. But we need a direct shot of stimulus somehow. Probably, in my best estimation, it will be for infrastructure, where you can employ the most amount of people for a period of time, as well as use materials and expand the economy that way. But you know what? It's just not going to happen. This government is all about expanding government. So there you go with that. I don't disagree. But in the end, the dollar is still the strong go-to currency in the world, as is the yen. Look at the debt situation they have. Their debt is a lot worse than ours. All right, this one comes from a hedge fund EQ. He says, "I think you have stumbled." This is actually a few of these are the same, a similar concept. "I think you may have stumbled on what could be the debate of the century. I think if you could get Dent to debate Schiff on your program, or the DH Unplugged program, where Dvorak has been a historian and depression predictor, We'd be able to quote and moderate. Okay, this is interesting. Rarely do you find two intelligent, well-spoken, non-biased market participants with similar negative views on the U.S. economy and the stock market having such differing opinions on exactly what's going to happen. I guess that's a good point. But I think that actually, just going back, I think that Schiff and Dent have similar opinions on the stock market. The question is the currency issue. So that would be kind of a neat thing we could do. Maybe we'll try to pull that off. So we'll try that. We'll see if we can get that. But, you know, I encourage everybody to look at Schiff's work and Dent's, and both with the same, you know, eye for, you know, what does this really mean for the future? And is this going to happen at this degree? Dent's calling for a collapse of the economy entirely of the U.S. and the world depression, where Schiff has been constantly talking about gold, which he's been right about, but a collapse of the U.S. dollar. So far, you know, 50-50. Let's see. This one is from, let's see what we have here. This one is all the way from Dublin. All right. This one, what's the name here? Let's see. Stephen Manning. He said, I've been listening to your podcast for about a year now and really enjoy it, from the guest, your opinion piece, etc. Thank you. All nice things right there. We'll get away from the niceties and talk about. He says, I'm doing a research piece and a thesis on the renewable energy industry, specifically commercialization of renewable resources in Europe. What opinions, if any, do you have on the industry? Do you think there's a future for the wind and wave and experiments and investments, given the anti-CO2 legislation that is impacting firm supply chains? Perhaps you're watching individual firms. Either way, you won't quote me in your paper. Hey, I expect you to quote me in your paper. All right, here's the deal. First of all, it's a very difficult thing to gauge right now. Yes, there is a definite future in renewable green energy alternatives. Clearly, there is a big move to that, especially from the BP disaster and the CO2 levels and carbon emissions, etc. The problem is where to invest. I mean, do you look at solar energy? The problem with solar energy is that they've been so reliant on government, initiatives. They've been looking at subsidies, and we see the wavering of the solar companies in the wind, if you will, by the various subsidies that are available. Germany, Spain have been big providers of, you know, additional revenue and development costs for many of these companies. And you know, you have to question, are they going to continue? They've been vacillating back and forth for a while. Wind, great opportunity, but, you know, the question is, what's the real cost of the wind experiments? Wave, if you can harness that or any other hydroelectric, that's a great thing. And there's plenty of other options. You know, you have the biogenetic fuels that are being formed utilizing wood, but at what cost to the lumber industry? Everything has a plus and a minus. And I'll give you the probably the greatest view of this that I have. When it comes to, let's say, the automobile industry and utilizing hybrid cars and or maybe pure either air-powered, or more importantly, probably the best example is 100% of electricity, like Tesla and other players out there. We have Tesla, we have Toyota, we have a variety of players out there looking to go into the all electrical level. The problem is, you know, do we have the grid that is sustainable, and what is going to power the electricity? In other words, electricity just doesn't come out of anywhere. So is that going to be the solar power that we talked about? We see a solar-powered plane take off last week. But, you know, you have to look at, what is that going to be? I mean, are we going to see this whole, situation change over, you know, over this time? So that's the kind of the issue that we're looking at here. Is the grid going to be able to maintain the available amount of energy? What is going to be the cost of that energy? And is that going to actually reduce the CO2? So think about that backwards. What is going to be the amount of energy required, and what is going to be the source of energy required for the electrical vehicle industry, and how is that created, and will that in fact be, number one, cost efficient, but number two, is it also going to be environmentally friendly? Those are things that I think we're looking at, and obviously the mecca, the holy grail of all of this is probably the, you know, areas of, you know, utilizing compressed air. There are manufacturers in Asia right now and a variety of other countries that are experimenting with compressed air. But you know what? You have to have filling stations with that. Then you have to have electricity that helps that. You know, you don't just get compressed air out of nowhere. Then you have the environmental issues there. You know, what is going to be the air in, air out process? You know, what's going to be the byproduct of this? Maybe nothing. Maybe it's perfect. But when you come to the whole green area, I think there's a lot of more hype and hysteria right now. It will take decades to convert our country and the rest of the world that wants to, by the way. Pretty much India and China have told us to, you know, given us the royal thumb up, if you will, or the thumb down, however you want to look at it. to their care about green, environmentally friendly. They are really more concerned with their economies moving forward any way possible. They don't care about the pollution. I mean, they care, but yet it doesn't look like they have major initiatives. And we could see that from Copenhagen. We could see that when there was meetings about all of this, and basically no decisions were made. Nothing has come of it. And it stopped President Obama and the U.S. in their tracks. By the way, speaking about President Obama, I encourage you to look at the Rasmussen polls. It shows him with a negative 16, the lowest it's been in a while. I think that all this pushing and prodding and the lack of support you've seen. Listen, he called LeBron James 8 times, and he didn't go to the place he wanted to go. And on top of that, didn't get the Olympics. And, you know, there's a lot of negativity floating around right now when it comes to this administration. So it looks like they're going on a big business initiative, saying how friendly they are and trying to sop up a lot of the problems they have with their overall, you know, reaction to the BP fiasco. So we'll see what happens with that. So, hey, those are great questions, great comments. There was a few more, but I don't think we'll get to them today. We have, if you want to write in, of course, just do it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Lots of paper shuffling. Sorry about that. Okay, so we're gonna finish off today with basically the wrap up of the commentary here today, and I want you to consider that we're in a very important inflection point when it comes to the markets right now. You need to watch the signals, watch the tape, watch the play. Low volume last week, even though we've had a follow through day, but I'll tell you something, that was a relief rally right now, which we think will ride as long as possible. And there's some great companies that are going to be coming out with earnings. I do envision that we're going to see a good earnings season. Again, the question is going to be, there's a very big question that has a lot of players sidelined right now. And the question is, what is going to be the outlook and the positive momentum that's going to allow for the continuation of a reasonable amount of upward trajectory for individual equity stocks in the stock market? Okay, so that's what we need to be looking for. That's what you need to be focusing on. The last thing I'll mention to you today is this, headline risk. You know what that is, as I see it at least? When you read headlines from Bloomberg, MSNBC, MSN, wherever you're getting your news sources from, be very careful. Headlines are meant to, you know, make you salivate, make you want more, make you go after the story by clicking. The headlines are not necessarily the facts. I've seen more headlines that have misconstrued the facts in order to drag people in a direction. You can't just read the headlines. Do me a favor. If you're, you know, just unable to read full articles, at least go to the article, read the first few paragraphs, and skim the rest. Find out if there is substance that backs up the claims in the headline, or if the headline was just a bait to get you there, because this is a confusing factor when it comes to investing. So many headlines will show a positive number trying to push a certain direction, particularly when it comes to, you know, some analysts out there. You know, you look at all these blogs that are writing things that are just, you know, trying to bring you in there, or at least, you know, fool you with some of the headline numbers. Be very careful when it comes to that. Don't believe that the news and the mainstream media is always fair and balanced, right? So just a word to the wise into this earnings season. With that, we're going to close up. A little bit of a shortened show today, but lots of information packed in there. We're going to have a lot more information on the show notes for you. We're going to have those questions that we mentioned before, what you need to be looking at during earnings season. And that's over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the podcast show notes. If you like the show, tell a friend. Get them on the iTunes platform so they can download it easily, or any of their other platforms that you could find out there. Listen to DH Unplugged, where we have all of our stock picks on a weekly basis. That's dhunplugged.com, or just grab that on iTunes as well. And if you want to listen to the Winning Investor Quick and Dirty Tips for Making Money in Any Market, that's available as well over at quickanddirtytips.com. I talk about all sorts of things there. And quick 5-minute vignettes that discuss markets, ratios, market timing, you know, technical analysis, fundamental analysis, things that you want to know about and need to hear. We'll see you next week. I thank you for joining me. Check it out over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Otherwise, go get some sun, have some fun. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.